Sorry the debates are over, said no one ever. But did the Russians really rig the Emmys? There are so many questions for us hombres, which means we need to turn to the political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Donald Trump needed a game-changing performance in Wednesday's third presidential debate. Did he manage to turn it around?
It wasn't until the end that he really kind of gave that, quote, such a nasty woman that I think was a very bad idea for him. And I think without that comment, we may be talking about a very different narrative coming out of that debate.
Americans are enthralled and aghast at this year's election. Is the view from Norway any different?
There is a lot of amusement because of the spectacle, but there is also a serious undertone to this. We have a lot of bonds with the United States, so Norwegians are taking this seriously.
And one Missouri politician recalls the loss of the state's popular governor, his father, in a 2000 plane crash right in the middle of a key Senate race.
That already won the Democratic primaries, and he had come to do an event, and that was the last time I saw him, and he didn't have much of an ego. He really wanted to do well by people and by the state that he loved.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 150 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin, coming to you from the studios of WBUR in Boston. It's not hyperbole to say that the most contentious, most surreal, most nasty series of presidential debates is now in the history books. Wednesday's finale in Las Vegas perhaps made it clear how much Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump differed from each other on a slew of issues that moderator Chris Wallace brought up. But if anything stood out in debate number three, it's that Clinton seemed to get under Trump's skin with jabs, sarcasm, and one-liners. Such a nasty woman, he said about her at one point. We'll review the debate in a moment. So where does that leave us? Clinton leads in every national poll and nearly every battleground state. If Trump needed the debate to get him back in the race, it's hard to make the case he succeeded. My electoral vote prediction sheet, assembled before the debate, had Clinton with 312, Trump with 226. Less than 3 weeks to go. One thing that stood out on Wednesday was that while Trump refused to promise to accept the results of the election, his running mate said the opposite. Indiana Governor Mike Pence earlier said Trump absolutely would accept what happens on November 8th. Of course, feuds between running mates, even presidents and their vice presidents, are not new. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last vice president who challenged his boss in the next election? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
You ask me if there'll come a time when I grow tired of you. Never my love. Never my love.
As we've noted many times in the past, presidential debates don't usually determine the outcome of the race. But if Donald Trump was banking on a strong performance to get him back into the game, he probably failed. And to hint that he might not even accept the results of the election, stay tuned, he says, was perhaps one of the most stunning statements a candidate has ever made. I'm bringing in Aaron Blake to talk about this. Aaron's a political reporter with the Washington Post. And Aaron, I have sad news to report. There will be no more presidential debates this year.
I will say that there is nothing that brings me more joy than hearing you say those few words there. I don't even know how we were doing three debates a week back in the primaries. It's just such a grind for the political reporters, and I don't mean to complain too much, but it really is a lot to take in at 9 o'clock at night when, you know, I for one am usually in bed already.
I mean, I've been covering debates since Lincoln Douglas, but I've never seen the kind of pettiness, cattiness, and meanness almost in these kind of debates.
Yeah, it was really, it's been pretty striking, especially from two people who, by the way, were chummy, were pals. Not too many years ago, Hillary Clinton went to the Melania and Donald Trump wedding. So the fact that they've really kind of turned on each other and become so bitter is, I think, really fascinating. What was really unusual about the third debate for me was it wasn't even necessarily Trump who was doing the kind of sniping and the prodding and the attacking. A lot of it was Hillary Clinton kind of jabbing at him, calling him a choker, you know, saying that he didn't know about his own tax plan, things like that, that really seemed to get his goat. So I think there is some real genuine distaste between those two people, perhaps owing in part to the fact that they used to be friends.
Yeah, the first question I was going to ask you is, what do you think of the job Alec Baldwin did last night? It sounded like a caricature at times.
He like dropped his voice, you know, a little bit lower, kind of in a Baldwin area of the spectrum. It was unusual. And, you know, he did seem to want to not get dragged into these squabbles. And I thought he did it for a good portion of the night. You know, he gave it back to her a little bit, but it wasn't until the end that he really kind of gave that very Trumpian quote, such a nasty woman, that I think was maybe a very bad idea for him. He avoided that kind of thing throughout the debate. He was able to do that in a way that I don't think he was previously. And I think without that comment and without the I may not accept the results of this election comment, we may be talking about a very different narrative coming out of that debate.
Going into the debate, people kept saying that Trump needed this Hail Mary to salvage, to rescue, to save his candidacy. But we both know that debates rarely accomplish that. And besides, Trump is pretty much way down in the polls for a debate to turn that around, don't you think?
Right. He is behind by a deficit which no candidate has ever recovered from in the history of the polling that we have. I looked at this the other day, and the closest that it comes at this point is Ronald Reagan being down by 6 points to Jimmy Carter in mid-October in one poll. So this was always a situation where he's got to throw a Hail Mary. He's got to try to do something to change this race and hope against hope that it actually has an impact. But it was always a long shot, and I'm not really sure there was anything he could do, particularly in a debate setting where he's not terribly good at it, and she certainly is. That was going to change this race. And so I think he was kind of trying to run out the clock on the debates and hope he can turn this race around in some other way, shape, or form.
And the fact remains that Hillary Clinton still has her vulnerabilities. I thought her answer on late-term abortion was not satisfying to everybody. Her answer on the Clinton Foundation meetings, Wall Street connections. It seemed like Trump had opportunities, but just didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah, and that's been a feature of Trump's debate performances, I think. You know, everybody thinks that he's this, you know, attack dog who's willing to go after his opponents constantly, and that's certainly the case. But in a debate, you need to be studied. You need to have a game plan. You need to have the details down, and you really need to follow through on these things and really make an effort to emphasize these attacks. And he's never been able to really drive them home and really keep things focused on those issues. And I think it's really been to his detriment more than a lot of things that I think people focus on, that he really can't make those things the focus of these debates. Even though, as you point out, I don't think the partial birth abortion answer was a very good one. I think it was a tough question for her. And Chris Wallace asked her a number of pretty pointed questions with premises that I think a lot of Republicans liked. They were tough questions, and they put her in a tough situation. But Trump wasn't able to pick the ball up from there and kind of carry it across the goal line.
And you almost knew this was going to happen when the WikiLeaks leak was mentioned at the debate. She pivoted to the fact that the Russians are influencing and trying to influence or rig this election. So let's listen to that tape.
What's really important about WikiLeaks is that the Russian government has engaged in espionage against Americans. They have hacked American websites, American accounts of private people, of institutions. Then they have given that information to WikiLeaks for the purpose of putting it on the internet. This has come from the highest levels of the Russian government, clearly from Putin himself, in an effort, as 17 of our intelligence agencies have confirmed, to influence our election.
I think this is a perfect example of her ability to change this debate to being on her terms and Trump's inability to focus it on her vulnerabilities. This is an issue which I think without Trump's problems would be the focus of this debate. And I think that it's incumbent upon Trump to try and make it the case. But he doesn't have all of his facts down. He doesn't have a game plan when it comes to really pressing the case. He's much more comfortable talking about this stuff in a rally setting. So I think that's a pretty telling example.
And the Russian interference didn't just come in the fact that the WikiLeaks argument. There was also this very interesting back and forth when Donald Trump was talking about how Vladimir Putin has no respect for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton.
He has no respect for her. He has no respect for our president. And I'll tell you what, we're in very serious trouble because we have a country with tremendous numbers of nuclear warheads, 1,800, by the way, where they expanded and we didn't, 1,800 nuclear warheads, and she's playing chicken. Look, Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of
no
the United
puppet.
States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty clear you won't admit that the Russians have engaged in cyber attacks against the United States of America, that you encouraged espionage against our people, that you are willing to spout the Putin line, sign up for his wish list, break up NATO, do whatever he wants to do, and that you continue to get help from him because he has a very clear favorite in this race.
Another good example of what I think Clinton did very successfully at this debate, which was constantly needling Trump and trying to draw him out to say something he regretted. He gave it back to her in this one instance. He didn't quite go there as far as saying things like she's a nasty woman. But I think a good example of kind of the continued effort from Clinton to continue to try and knock him off his game and get him to say something that would call people to question his temperament.
But I was going to say, I mean, not a puppet. No, you're the puppet. I don't mean to insult fifth graders, but this sounds very fifth gradish.
Yeah, it's a little bit even more telling than that. This has been an entire part of Trump's campaign in which he's attacked for something, and he basically uses that very same attack on his opponents. It's not just the Bill Clinton stuff where he's, you know, Trump is attacked on women, and so he attacks Bill Clinton on women. There is a whole series of stuff. He's attacked Hillary Clinton for her temperament, even though the polls suggest that's not even close to her problem. There are so many issues like that where he will just take whatever he's being attacked for and use it against his opponents to muddy the waters.
And he attacked her on her 30 years of experience. What were you doing during those 30 years? Let's listen to that tape.
Back in the 1970s, I worked for the Children's Defense Fund, and I was taking on discrimination against African-American kids in schools. He was getting sued by the Justice Department for racial discrimination in his apartment buildings. In the 1980s, I was working to reform the schools in Arkansas. He was borrowing $14 million from his father to start his businesses. In the 1990s, I went to Beijing, and I said, women's rights are human rights. He insulted a former Miss Universe, Alicia Machado, called her an eating machine. And on the day when I was in the Situation Room monitoring the raid that brought Osama bin Laden to justice, he was hosting the Celebrity Apprentice. So I'm happy to compare my 30 years of experience, what I've done for this country, trying to help in every way I could, especially kids and families, get ahead and stay ahead with your 30 years, and I'll let the American people make that decision.
I think this was mostly a good line of attack for Trump, fertile territory, certainly, especially given how people don't like politicians and don't think politicians these days actually get things done. And there she was at the end, kind of throwing in that dig. I thought he could have done a better job focusing on, you know, the Washington Post report of her promise of creating jobs in upstate New York. that never came to fruition, an attack that probably could have used some more detail and maybe forced a little bit more of a response from Clinton. Instead, she was able to basically change the subject into Donald Trump reality TV show star.
And he loves to always to remind everybody what Bernie Sanders said during the primaries about Hillary Clinton.
This is an old and kind of tired Trump argument, which is that, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters should maybe come over and support him. Very, very few are doing that. I'm not sure what this proves at this point, besides the fact that Sanders and Clinton were running against each other in a primary. There were certainly nasty things said about his supporters, Chris Christie, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, all those guys said very nasty things about Donald Trump. So I don't think this one really proved much of anything. I do think Clinton was certainly ready for it, as she was basically anything that came her way in this debate.
I want to save the best for last, or at least the most significant to me, the last, when Chris Wallace asked Donald Trump about accepting the results of the election.
Mr. Trump, I want to ask you about one last question in this topic. You have been warning at rallies recently that this election is rigged and that Hillary Clinton is in the process of trying to steal it from you. Your running mate, Governor Pence, pledged on Sunday that he and you, his words, will absolutely accept the result of this election. Today, your daughter Ivanka said the same thing. I want to ask you here on the stage tonight, do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely, sir, that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time. What I've seen, she shouldn't be allowed to run. She's guilty of a very, very serious crime. She should not be allowed to run. And just in that respect, I say it's rigged. Because she should never have been allowed to run for the presidency based on what she did with emails and so many other things.
But, sir, there is a tradition in this country. In fact, one of the prides of this country is the peaceful transition of power, and that no matter how hard fought a campaign is, that at the end of the campaign, that the loser concedes to the winner. Not saying that you're necessarily going to be the loser or the winner, but that the loser concedes to the winner, and that the country comes together in part for the good of the country. Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?
What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
Well, okay? Chris, let me respond to that, because that's horrifying. You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. Then Trump University gets sued for fraud and racketeering. He claims the court system and the federal judge is rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged against
him. Should have gotten it.
This is a mindset. This is how Donald thinks.
Aaron, what do you make of that? Have you ever heard any candidate in history make a comment like that?
No, in a word. I don't know that many candidates would even get that question asked of them, but Trump has certainly opened the door to it by talking about massive voter fraud. He at one point said that he couldn't lose the state of Pennsylvania except through voter fraud. This is a state where he is losing by upwards of the high single digits or even double digits. He's invited this question upon himself. Of course, it's his nature to be a provocateur, to leave that question open and not take a stance on it. But this has caused the Republican Party a significant amount of heartburn right now. They don't like the idea that he's going to draw this whole thing out past Election Day, and so they're trying to get him to tone it down. He did have a rally on Thursday right after the debate in which he actually said, "I will accept the result of the election if it's clear." And then he also said, "I will accept the result of the election if I win." So, you know, this is a big joke to Trump, and he likes that we're all freaking out about it. But it is remarkable that we have a candidate who's basically flirting with the idea of blaming his loss on yet-to-be-take-place voter fraud and a big media conspiracy against him. I'm having a hard time deciding whether this is something he's going to follow through on or if he's just happy that we're all talking about it so much right now.
You're listening to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Let me ask you a quick, the role of Chris Wallace. How do you think he did?
I thought he did a fantastic job. I thought he asked tough questions of both sides. I think in particular the drilling down on the abortion stuff was something that we don't really see a whole lot in a debate setting, and I thought he came at it from the angle of critics of both positions, especially partial birth abortion, late-term abortions, really pressing Clinton on that. I think that gave Wallace a lot of credibility. I don't think he did much of anything in this debate that could draw the kind of criticism we've seen from past moderators.
He was a pretty good hombre, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he'll be back in doing future general election debates, and I hope he is.
I think the final question really is, did Donald Trump blow a chance to change the dynamic, or did he really never have a chance? Is it too late for him?
I don't know if it's too late overall. Certainly there have been swings that have happened late in the race, none of them with a candidate this far behind. But I don't think that the narrative was going to change at this debate. I think Trump knows that Clinton is a better debater than he is. I think he went into this debate not thinking that he was going to change it there, but that he was going to have to do something outside of the debate setting. And so stay tuned for that, I guess.
Aaron Blake is a political reporter with The Washington Post. Aaron, less than 3 weeks to go.
And then we sleep.
That's what you think. Well, let's see what happens on November 9th. Aaron, thanks so much.
Yep, take care now.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic psychotic.
As I mentioned earlier, I'm in Boston for a debate-watching event sponsored by WBUR. The audience did not hold back its reactions to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, alternating between applause and boos, approval and disgust. That's pretty much been the case around the country this election year. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to travel overseas. Hilda Restad is an associate professor of international studies at Bjørknes College in Oslo, Norway. Professor Restad, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hi, Ken. Glad to be with you.
Did I pronounce everything right?
Perfectly.
Oh, wow. Okay. And I see that you also studied American foreign policy at the University of Virginia.
I did.
Did I pronounce that right, too?
You sure did.
Okay. Well, you've been watching this campaign from afar, and if you had to sum up your reaction to American democracy at work, and I think I did quotes around that, what would it be?
Oh, gosh, it's painful to watch, Ken, as someone who is very interested in and quite fond of the United States. It's a little bit difficult to be discussing this with Norwegians at the moment. Norwegians are watching this like some sort of live horror show, and it's hard to watch right now.
You've obviously been in the United States, you've studied here, but for many Norwegians who are maybe getting their first look or their latest look at American democracy at work, I mean, are they stunned? Are they appalled? Are they amused? What are you hearing?
There is a lot of amusement, but because of the spectacle. But there is also a serious undertone to this. Norwegians are very invested in the United States. You know, there are more Norwegian Americans living in the United States than there are Norwegians living in Norway. We have a lot of bonds with the United States, so Norwegians are taking this seriously, and I think they're kind of sad. In 2008, they were extremely excited and invested in the election of Barack Obama, and it seems now, 8 years later, that things have changed for the worse.
Well, it's changed in this country, too. What do they know of Donald Trump, and what did they, I mean, what when they watched the rise of Donald Trump, what did they first expect, and how do they see him now?
I have to admit, I was one of those pundits that predicted that Donald Trump would never get the nomination, and I think
you're not alone. You know that.
I am in good company. I understand. I think most Norwegians didn't take him seriously. You know, each election cycle, you have certain candidates that people don't take seriously that are seen more like clowns, perhaps. And Donald Trump was definitely one of those guys, but he certainly showed us, didn't he?
And what do you make of the fact that Hillary Clinton being the first female, the possibility of her being the first female presidential president in history, does that resonate with women in Norway?
I think it really does, and not just women. I think also Norwegian men. You know, we had a female prime minister already in the 80s, much like Britain had Margaret Thatcher. So for us, we're sort of thinking, well, you know, maybe it's about time the United States catches up on this one.
You've written a book, American Exceptionalism, an idea that made a nation and remade the world. Tell me, what is American exceptionalism?
The way I define it is as an identity, as a self-perception among Americans about what the meaning of America is in the world and in world history. And in my book, I write about what this sort of idea or identity has meant for how the United States acts on the world stage through history. And, of course, I look a little bit at what it has meant for certain kind of maybe unilateralism throughout U.S. history. You know, when you're exceptional, you kind of want to do things your own way because you're a little bit better than everyone else, and you know a little bit better what you should do, so you sort of, you want to show other people the right way.
I was going to say, is that a compliment, or is it talking about American arrogance, or is it a combination of both?
It's very multifaceted, isn't it? From the Western European perspective, we love to complain about American arrogance, but at the same time, we are completely dependent on the United States. Norway has hinged its entire security on NATO and the United States. So it's a love-hate relationship. We can't live with you, but we certainly cannot live without you.
You know, I guess the debate, and even in this country, has always been, should the United States be the policeman of the world, or does it retreat into isolationism? And I think after all these years of perhaps failed policy unending wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there seems to be a move towards isolationism. What does that mean for Western Europe, and what does that mean for Norway?
Well, I have to say this term isolationism is, in my opinion, not a very good term. I don't think the United States has ever really been isolationist, but certainly there's an understandable desire to retreat just a little bit because, during the Bush administration, the United States was completely overextended, which I think is what Barack Obama has tried to do, but ironically has been very criticized for trying to just retrench just a tiny bit. But certainly Donald Trump has been tapping into this historic tradition of, you know, America first, let's take care of our own country before we spend money and lives taking care of other countries, which is certainly understandable, but there is a large part of the world out there that certainly looks to the United States to be engaged. And so there are many political leaders in Western Europe, certainly, that are eagerly awaiting the results of this election.
Given the kind of attention that this presidential election has gotten, not only in the United States, but around the world, how closely do you think Norwegians will be watching the results on November 8th?
Oh, my gosh, people will be staying up all night. You know, this time difference is really not making us it's not doing us any favors. We're all sleep deprived over here trying to keep up with your debates and your election nights. All my students will be up all night long following CNN International for sure.
And the Political Junkie as well.
Of course they will, Ken.
That was the right answer, Hilda. Hilda Restad is an associate professor of international studies at Bjørknes College in Oslo, Norway, and she's the author of American Exceptionalism. Hilda, tusen takk. What just happened? We were speaking Norwegian. Thank you, Hilda.
We sure were.
Thank you.
I appreciate this so much. This has been the highlight of my life, Ken.
I love sarcasm. Hilda, thank you.
No, it actually was not sarcasm.
Talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Oslo in the summertime. Oslo in the summertime. Oslo in the summertime, Pakistani children play, locked inside of the courtyard all day. Pretty people everywhere, some left hands and flaxen hair, just tell the American not to stare. Ah.
That's The View from Norway. For The View from New Mexico, we have Sam Donaldson, the legendary former White House correspondent and four-time Emmy winner who spent four decades at ABC News. Sam Donaldson, it's great to have you on The Political Junkie.
I'm glad to talk to you, Ken, but don't use the word legendary. That's one word away from the word calcified.
I did mention Emmy winner, but I heard from the debate that Donald Trump, I understand that the Emmys are rigged.
Well, I suppose so, because I didn't get as many as Ted Koppel, who must have gotten about 862. I got one or two.
I assume you watched Wednesday night's debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
I did. Wouldn't miss it. I mean, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. I have never attended a cockfight and a greased pig contest, but if you put the two together, I think that's been this year's political discourse. And I regret it, and I think most Americans do also.
You know, I think of your career, and I won't use that L word again, but I know that you covered President Kennedy's funeral, the Vietnam War, the Watergate hearings. You covered the White House for when Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan were there, were president. But do you have any regrets not covering this campaign?
No, I don't think I could be objective. I mean, it's a rap on the press to say, you know, we're all out to elect or defeat so-and-so and so-and-so. We're all out to try to cover, objectively, the people that we're assigned to. And sometimes we fail being human beings. I know I would fail this year. I just say that, so I would have no place trying to be on the bus. You know, the first bus I was on for a presidential campaign was 1964. And it was the biggest landslide loss in our history for the guy I was covering, Barry Goldwater. But when it was over, Barry said, okay, fine, and went back to the Senate. He continued to contribute. And, of course, his philosophy came to fruition in 1980 when Ronald Reagan, who was one of his disciples, was elected. Barry Goldwater is, I think, a test of how you conduct yourself in our country, thank goodness. Donald Trump, he's laughable.
I don't remember Barry Goldwater ever questioning the in advance whether the election was rigged or whether the results were acceptable to him.
No, of course not. And the fact is, I think a lot of people know this, Barry Goldwater and John F. Kennedy, who were pretty good friends, although, of course, on opposite sides of the political aisle when they were in the Senate, had agreed to campaign together in 1964. They both thought they might be the nominee. Of course, Kennedy thought he'd be the nominee of his party, of course. And they were going to go use the same airplane with the same press corps, come to, let's say, Albuquerque, where I am now, go on the same stage together. They'd argue back and forth and take questions. What a wonderful example that might have been had John Kennedy lived. And from that point to today, look at what's happened to our political process. And you know who's responsible, Ken? It's us. Oh, you say, well, the media is responsible? I mean, all of us American citizens. We've decided to hate each other instead of arguing out our differences, taking a vote. Whoever wins, wins, and the losers say, okay, I'll be back in 2 years or 4 years, and I'm going to try again. What's happened to that?
Well, how would you, I mean, regarding whose fault it is, how would you assess the role of the news media, especially given the rise of Donald Trump?
I think it's been very difficult. And, of course, the media today is everybody. Hey, go on the Internet, have a blog, have a tweet. You're the media. It's not just the old days when the newspapers and three television networks were called the media. Although when I started in this business, Ken, if you didn't like something you read or heard, you say, well, I don't like the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or ABC's got it wrong. I never heard the word media applied to everyone from Rush Limbaugh to the Times or the Post or the Dallas Morning News or the Gazette newspaper, wherever you are. And now it's all one big lump. So to say, well, how'd the media do? Well, folks, you tell me how your particular publication did, or your particular network, or your particular website, or the tweet that you think is wonderful. You tell me.
And there's one, and there's now talk that should he lose on November 8th, there will be another variation of a Trump media empire.
Well, yes, he'll go on. I mean, I know him. In 1990, I did an interview with the Donald. He was kind of on the ropes because of his borrowed money, which, since we had a little recession then, he was unable to meet his demands. Of course, in the interview with me, the Plaza Hotel's wonderful, and Trump Airlines, no problem. I'm going to sell my yacht for $115 million. He'd put it about $35 million into it. He eventually sold it for $20 million. He lost all of the money that he borrowed from the Plaza Hotel, from the Trump Airlines, the Taj Mahal, which just closed its doors. It was taken over by Carl Icahn, his old friend, when he couldn't meet the payments on that. But it was the Trump, arrogant, full of himself, telling me how ignorant I was. Well, of course, Ken, truth is a defense, so maybe he's got me there. Saying, well, if you were smart, you want to see my books. What do you mean borrowed money? I said, okay, send the books. We'll hire a accounting firm that's mutually acceptable, and they'll look over the books, and they'll tell us. My program then was with Diane Sawyer called Primetime Live. Well, I might do that. Well, I'm still waiting for his book, just like we're waiting for his tax return.
Lots of luck with that, right. You know, we were talking about the role of the media, and there's a lot of verdicts already in about Chris Wallace's role on Wednesday night. How do you assess how he did?
Great, great. Chris was the best of them all. It's no surprise to me. I worked against Chris in the White House in the Reagan years. He was the NBC correspondent. I was the ABC correspondent. I liked him then. Oh, we tried to beat each other, and frequently he beat me. And I got in one or two licks on him. I've always been a Wallace fan. Wallace Pierre, Wallace Field, Mike, Chris. I was very proud of him last night, very proud.
You were talking about the possibility of a Barry Goldwater JFK debate in 64 that they were going to travel together. Remember after Barry Goldwater lost to Lyndon Johnson in that overwhelming landslide of 64, where he won only about six states, there was always talk about, well, the future of the Republican Party. I mean, the Republican Party is finished. And, of course, 2 years later, the GOP won, I think, 47 seats in the House. And 2 years after that, Richard Nixon was elected. Similarly with George McGovern in 72, when he lost 49 states, oh, the Democratic Party is finished. Forget about it. It'll be Republicans forever. And then 2 years later was Watergate, and 2 years later was Jimmy Carter. So, I mean, obviously, we always write the obituary of a political party. Party and we're always wrong, but what do you envision for the Republican Party come November 9th of this year?
You can write the obituary of the Republican Party as it has existed today, but I don't think it'll continue to exist as it exists today. It will change. It's a great party. I grew up in a Republican household here in New Mexico. We need two parties, and we need a conservative-leaning party to take care of their constituents, like we need a Democratic Party to take care of its constituents. What the Republican Party has to do is understand the country has changed. And although wistfully maybe a lot of us would like to go back, we're not going back. This country is going forward. Our demographics have changed. Young people are getting married. Two young girls are marrying each other, and two young boys are marrying each other. And go on down the list of things that have changed. You can either accept it, whether you like it or not, make it work for you and go on, as a political party must, or you can get bitter, you can try to, like King Canute, stop against the tide, and you're not going to win. You're not going to... Look, in 1996, Bob Dole got a certain percentage of white vote, but he lost. In 2008, had John McCain gotten that same percentage of the white vote, he would have beaten Barack Obama. But each year, the old demographics are changing, and the Republican Party cannot exist with just the white vote, just the Southern vote. To your point about Barry Goldwater, won six states, including five Southern states. Same guys. They just said, we're Republicans now because of what Lyndon Johnson did. That Civil Rights Act that let all those dark people sit at the lunch counter. We're now going to be Republicans. The Republican Party cannot exist believing that's its base. Trump played to the bigotry. He played. I'm not saying all his supporters were bigots. I'm simply saying he played those cards. And he got, what, about 37% of the primary vote. And now it looks like he's not going to get even 40% of the national vote because the people he's appealing to don't have those numbers. Thank goodness. It's not the country.
You covered Ronald Reagan during his presidency, and of course you're widely remembered for shouting out questions at Ronald Reagan, maybe because he couldn't hear or maybe because he didn't want to hear Sam Donaldson. But if you could shout out something at Ronald Reagan today and say, what do you think of what's going on in the Republican Party and with Donald Trump, what do you think the Gipper would say?
He might try to make a one-line joke, which wouldn't be funny in the sense that he'd try to pass it off. But I think... there have been too many people recently say, oh, if they were alive, they'd be, spinning in their grave now. I think Reagan would be appalled. I know that before her death, Nancy Reagan was appalled at what's happened and what was happening in our political season and to the Republican Party.
Sam Donaldson is the former White House correspondent for ABC and the anchor of many of its news programs. Sam, it's wonderful having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, I appreciate talking to you, Ken, and to your audience, and now you see why I said I couldn't have covered this campaign objectively, okay?
Well, at least you still have your four Emmys.
Oh, great.
Thanks, Sam.
Bye-bye.
What's going on?
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last person elected president in the same year both houses of Congress switched parties? The answer is Dwight Eisenhower. When he was first elected in 1952, Ike carried along with him a new Republican House and Senate. The randomly selected winner is Lisa Heimbach of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum, we'll take Ike to Washington.
We don't want John
or Dean
or Harry,
let's do that big job right. Let's get in step with the guy that's hep, get in step with Ike. You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum, we'll take Ike to Washington.
It's time for This Week in Political History. Politics, as we certainly know, can be nasty and ugly. We fight over issues and ideology and personality. But sometimes terrible things happen that make all of that insignificant. That's what happened on This Week in 2000.
A plane believed to be carrying Governor Mel Carnahan, his son Roger, and senior campaign advisor Chris Sifford went down in Jefferson County.
We heard a large explosion which shook our patio doors.
And the whole house just shook.
There were no survivors.
Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan, the Democratic nominee to take on Senator John Ashcroft that year in a tight election, perished in a plane crash that also took the lives of his older son Randy and his closest campaign aide. They were heading to a Get Out the Vote campaign event when the plane went down in rain and fog. Carnahan died too late to replace his name on the ballot. The two parties were in a trance during those final 3 weeks of the campaign. Ashcroft didn't know what to do. He pulled his TV commercials. The new governor, Roger Wilson, said he would appoint Carnahan's widow, Jean, to the seat if he won. As it turned out, Carnahan did win, although narrowly, and Jean Carnahan was named to the seat. Russ Carnahan, son of Mel and Jean Carnahan, followed in his parents' footsteps. He was elected to Congress in 2004 and served through 2012. This year, he's the Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Missouri and was kind enough to take time out of his campaign to be on the program. Russ Carnahan, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Ken, thank you. It's good to be with you.
I appreciate you being on the show more than you know, and as you also know, your dad was a very popular governor and a beloved public servant. I know it's 16 years later, but I guess the pain doesn't really lessen with time, does it?
Well, no, but the blessing for me is, you know, hardly a day goes by I don't meet someone, oftentimes a stranger, that will share a story about a way that he touched their lives or their community. And so it's just a wonderful way to remember him and be reminded of his work.
Where were you when you heard the news?
I was at my home in St. Louis.
And do you remember the last conversation you had with him?
I do. I'll never forget it. He'd actually come to an event in South St. Louis. I was the Democratic nominee for a state House of Representatives seat on the same ballot with him. And it was a strong Democratic seat, and I'd already won the Democratic primary, so my race was pretty much done, and he had come to do an event at a senior citizen center there not far from my neighborhood. And that was the last time I saw him, and he gave me this great introduction to the people that were there. So it was a great way to remember him.
When the acting governor, Roger Wilson, said he would appoint your mom to the seat if he won, I can't even begin to imagine what was going on with the family. You had suffered such unimaginable losses. Was there any question whether your mom would agree to take the seat, take the appointment?
Well, it was a deeply personal decision for her, and certainly family was going to support her no matter what she decided. But she ultimately decided in the middle of that very difficult time to go forward with really keeping his ideas and memory alive, and in just amazing ways, people responded to that.
I remember those Still With Mel buttons in those final days. Did your mom campaign at all? I can't imagine what the rest of the campaign, those final 3 weeks, were like.
Not really that much active campaigning. Some of the staff activities continued, and there was a now famous letter that had gone out signed by Senator Eagleton, late Senator Eagleton, and others, saying that they were still with Mel and encouraged people to do the same. And that kind of became the theme for the campaign.
What do you remember most about him?
You know, I guess just his warm and such personal demeanor. Some of my first memories of him as a kid, just him being active with things around the house and in our community, but as a young man actually working in his campaigns, and we spent hours and hours and hours together in the car traveling with him during his campaigns, and we have fond memories of that car time that we had together, and really watching him interact with people. He really had a very warm and easy connection with people. And he didn't have much of an ego. He really wanted to do well by people and by the state that he loved. And he didn't really care all that much about who got the credit. He just wanted to get it done. So that's, to me, one of the most amazing things about him.
Well, the day after the tragedy was the third and final debate between Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush. That was the debate in St. Louis. Here's how moderator Jim Lehrer began.
Before proceeding tonight, we would like to observe a moment of silence in memory of Governor Mel Carnahan of Missouri, who, along with his son and his former chief of staff, died in a private plane crash last night near St. Louis.
It seemed like the whole nation was in mourning with your family. I think we all felt that.
And our family did as well. It was an amazing outpouring of love and support that we'll never forget, and was great comfort to get through that just unbelievable time.
Well, I remember President Clinton delivering one of the many eulogies at the funeral. I just want us to listen to some of that.
So if he were here, and in a way he is, he would say, okay, so I had a lot more I wanted to do, but I had a good ride. And it's not so bad being up there. The boys are good company, and I'm looking down on you. You know what to do. While you have time, do good. We'll miss you, Mel. We'll try to take up the slack, but we'll not have another one like you. God bless you, and Godspeed.
16 years later, Russ, I am so sorry for the loss of your dad and your brother. I am so sorry.
Well, thank you. We lost him too soon, but he loved what he did and was good at it and made a difference. And that's great inspiration for me and many others that I run into on a regular basis. So I appreciate that.
Russ Carnahan is a former member of Congress from Missouri and is the 2016 Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. Russ Carnahan, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Ken.
It was 16 years ago this week, on October 16, 2000, when Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan, campaigning for the Senate against Republican incumbent John Ashcroft, died in a plane crash, along with his son Randy and his chief campaign aide. Mel Carnahan would go on to be posthumously elected to the Senate. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. A special thanks this week to WBUR in Boston for the use of its studios in this week's program. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. Michael Garth is our engineer in Boston. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.